From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may be familiar with the story in A Clockwork Orange, Anthony Burgess's dystopian novella published in 1962. The book is narrated by a young thug, a horrible sociopath named Alex, who lives in a world of the future, runs with a group of thugs who have their own dialect, and they commit these violent crimes. Many of you are familiar with the story because of Stanley Kubrick's film, but today we're focusing on the book. We'll talk about Anthony Burgess and his ideas in the book. We'll also get at what he thought about the movie, which, by the way, you can see this weekend. It's showing at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. So, A Clockwork Orange today, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about A Clockwork Orange. Many of you know it as the surreal and violent film by Stanley Kubrick, and you can see that film, by the way, this weekend. It's showing at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. But today, we're talking about the book. The film, of course, is based on this novella by the British writer Anthony Burgess. He created this dystopian landscape with violent teenagers who have their own language. Andrew Biswell is our guest today. He directs the International Anthony Burgess Foundation, the editor of the restored text version of A Clockwork Orange, joined us from the studios of the BBC in Manchester, England. Well, I wanted to begin with, let's start with what you think is maybe the popular, I guess, perception of A Clockwork Orange. What do you think most people understand or know about, you know, about the book, I guess, as compared to the movie?
Well, I think it's at this point very difficult to detach the book from the film. And very often people come to the movie before they've seen, before they've read the book.
Right.
I think by reputation, Burgess is a very kind of violent writer. And this is the thing, of course, because it's such a prominent feature of the novel that people know about, almost even if they haven't read the novel itself. Mm-hmm. They're aware of its reputation for atrocity and violence and so forth. And in fact, I mean, one of the things I found when I came back to the book and typing out every line, thinking about each sentence within it, is that it's very carefully weighted. In fact, it's divided into three sections. And yes, the first section is about crime, but as Burgess saw it, and he said this as he was writing it in letters to his friends, sections 2 and 3 are about punishment. And this is the aspect of it that all often gets overlooked, I think. It is a book of kind of balances and internal tensions, and to say that it's a story about crime is to misrepresent it in some ways, I think.
Yeah. Did you say, did I hear you right? Did you say you typed it out? You went through to get a sense of the kind of the rhythm of it? Is that how it worked for you?
Well, that was part of the process, yes, because the editions which had been around up to now were rather old. They were put together 40 or 50 years ago. There was no electronic text, so wanting very much for it to come around again as an e-book. In Europe, it's available as an app for the iPad and so forth. I thought it would be easier to type it out by hand rather than scan it or something. It's also a way, of course, to get you very close to the language. It slows down the pace at which you can read. And it was an opportunity to think about each sentence and annotate. And there was a lot there that I'd never seen before. I've been reading this novel for 25 years, but there are particular points of language that, I mean, when you're reading, you normally read quite quickly, even such a strange book as this. And I think that opportunity to dwell and linger on individual words and phrases and sentences was part of the pleasure of going back to the novel and correcting the text, working from the manuscript, but also thinking about it line by line.
Mm. Well, I want to get to here in a moment. I want to play the first paragraphs, the first section, the first section of from the book. But before we do, I was interested in what is it that got you interested in Anthony Burgess? Was it A Clockwork Orange or was it something else?
Well, this was the first of his books that I read. When I was about 15, which is the age that the character Alex, the narrator, is supposed to be at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
And like many teenagers, like many adolescents, I felt that I could relate to what the book was saying about youth, the kind of disaffection of youth and maybe the alienation one feels from the world of grown-ups, not being quite grown-up yourself. And shortly afterwards, I went on to read Burgess's autobiography and some other of his novels. But like most people, I came to this one first, yeah.
So I want to play from the very beginning, where Alex is introducing himself to us. And I want to have you, if you would, Andrew Biswell, set this up for us, if you would. And for those who are uninitiated to the work, there's a dialect, of course. There's a certain language, which we'll talk about, by the way, as we go along in the conversation. But give us a sense of what we're going to hear. Is there a kind of rhythm to it? Because I want to play some of this so people get a sense of what it sounds like.
Well, I think the things to look out for here are, as you say, the rhythm, but also the wit of the individual utterances and sentences. Burgess was a musician before he came to writing fiction. He had written two symphonies, and he composed about 150 other musical works through his lifetime. And I think it's useful to think of him as a writer who was a kind of musician manqué. It was music rather than literature that was, as he thought about it, his primary vocation. Now, the language, as you've said, that's one of the main points of excitement, especially to readers who come to this work for the first time, because it's one of the few novels that's written in a kind of invented language, anywhere in invented slang. And there are very few comparable examples elsewhere in literature. Tolkien does it a bit. Mm. He invents, you know, Elvish, for example, in The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And later, Russell Hoban in his novel Ridley Walker, a very kind of Clockwork Orangey book in itself. But there weren't that many precedents for this kind of writing when Burgess wrote it in 1961.
Well, let's hear. This is Anthony Burgess reading from. It's not actually from the top, this particular section. It's though it's from chapter one. I was interested. What do you think of Anthony Burgess's reading of his own work? Is it good to hear it from him?
I loved listening to his voice. He was a real showman, a performer. I mean, theatre was in his blood. Both of his parents had worked in theatres and music halls and so forth. And he'd been a school teacher, which is, as he always maintained, another kind of acting. I think very often when he's reading from his work, it's dramatic. It's also an improvisation. If you follow it with the text, you'll find he deviates from it. He's kind of, working with his own text, sometimes improving on it. When he makes these recordings. I think the one we're going to hear is from 1973, so it's about a decade after the book was published.
Here it is. This is Anthony Burgess reading from his book, A Clockwork Orange.
Our pockets were full of deng, so there was no real need, from the point of view of crusting any more Pretty Polly, to tolchock some old vec in an alley and vidy him swim in his blood while we counted the take-ins and divided by four. Nor to do the ultra-violent on some shivering, starry, grey-haired pizza in a shop and go smecking off with the till's guts. But as they say, money isn't everything. The four of us were dressed in the height of fashion, which in those days was a pair of black, very tight tights with the old jelly mould, as we called it, fitting on the crotch underneath the tights. This bid to protect, and also a sort of a design you could vidy clear enough in a certain light, so that I had one in the shape of a spider, Pete had a rooker, Georgie had a very fancy one of a flower, and poor old Dim had a very hound and horny one of a clown's litzo, a face, that is. Dim not ever having much of an idea of things, and being beyond all shadow of a doubt in Thomas, the dimmest of we four. Then we wore waisty jackets without lapels, but with these very big built-up shoulders, plechos we called them, which were a kind of a mockery of having real shoulders like that. Then, my brothers, we had these off-white cravats which looked like whipped-up kartoffel or spud, with a sort of a design made on it with a fork. We wore our hair not too long, and we had flip horror show boots for kicking.
For kicking. He's great, by the way, reading this. He's really terrific. So, Andrew Biswell, let me ask you, for those who are reading this for the first time, do you suggest a kind of patience? Because once you get the rhythm of it, then it seems to really flow. But it seems like it takes a while to kind of warm into it, I guess.
I think that's right. I think it always takes a page or two to kind of tune in.
Yeah.
And to begin with, you know, the normal experience of reading A Clockwork Orange is you tend to have to take it quite slowly for the first few pages or for the first couple of chapters. But I do think that once you've tuned in to, you know, as it were, the wavelength of the book, it becomes much easier. And he gives you a lot of help.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of argument between Burgess and his publishers about whether there should be a kind of dictionary, a glossary of this invented language at the back of the book. And he always maintained that you didn't need it, because normally where you're being introduced to a new word, it's clear from the context approximately what the word means, whether it's a body part or, you know, a verb or an adjective or whatever it is. And actually, he'd done the same before he came to write this book. Burgess, who'd lived in what was then the old colonial Malaya in the 1950s, he'd written three novels about the end of the empire, using lots of the languages of that particular place, including Malay and Chinese and Tamil and Arabic and so on. And again, he used in that Malayan trilogy the same technique of deploying words which were probably unfamiliar to a lot of English-speaking readers, but whose context would be clear. And again, he published those three novels without a glossary. So there are precedents for this kind of writing in his earlier work.
Let's talk about 1961. I think it was the summer of 1961. He travels to St. Petersburg. He goes there in some ways to study the Russian language or the dialects there. But I guess he didn't have the intent of creating a dialect based on the Russian language, at least not originally.
I think when he went to St. Petersburg, as it is now, then it was known as Leningrad,
right,
in the summer of 1961, he had no intention of writing a novel at all. I mean, he'd been sent there by his publisher, who'd paid him to go to write a kind of travel book, a documentary book about the Soviet Union. And it was only when he was there that he kind of went around with his wife and he was kind of talking to people, thinking about, you know, Russian culture and the ways in which what he saw, the emergence of a youth culture, kind of reminded him of what was going on back home in England.
Mm.
And he'd been living through most of the 1950s in the East, in Malaysia and in Brunei. And then coming back from those excursions, he'd been very surprised by this, you know, the kind of coming up of teenagers and, you know, a concept not much known in his childhood. You had young men and then you had men and nothing in between. And he was very, very kind of troubled, very interested, but also quite skeptical about things like fashion and pop music, which he hated as a serious classical composer.
Right.
He didn't like young people's music. He found it left him completely cold. And he had some very unkind things to say about people like the Beatles and Elvis Presley, the Rolling Stones, who is still kind of venerating now, of course.
Yeah.
So going to St. Petersburg and witnessing kind of delinquency and lawlessness of a pretty low-grade kind. And he was expecting Soviet Russia to be all about the secret police arresting people. And actually, he said of his experience of being there, there seemed to be no police at all. It was, you know, pretty much people expected to police themselves.
Mm.
But he was very struck by these comparisons that occurred to him between the people he'd left behind in England, the kind of young, very well-dressed, quite violent, lawless young people, and what he saw in Russia. And it's at that point, I think, that he thought that there was a story here about kind of crime and delinquency and punishment. And it was in the course of that journey that things began to coalesce. And by the time he came back, he had, you know, a page of notes in his notebook, out of which emerged this Clockwork Orange novel, which incidentally he was going to call A Cherry and the Maggot, I think, which would have been a terrible title. Clockwork Orange is much better.
Yeah. Well, I guess the idea, the initial idea you've talked about is he has this, it is a young violent man. It is a different name, at least in the initial concept. I mean, what does he have when he goes to Russia? How much of the novel has he put together? Does he know that it's three sections? Does he know that it deals with this and that this brainwashing technique, I mean, you know, how much does he have it worked out when he's in Russia?
I think with Burgess, his standard way of planning a novel was to think on the level of the chapter, or that this book's going to have three sections. There are going to be five or six chapters in each section. And he would make notes along the lines of a couple of words describing what happened in each chapter. Mm. But he didn't plan in a comprehensive way. I think there was something quite superstitious about that, maybe. He thought that if he knew in too much detail what he was going to write, he would then not wish to write it. And he wasn't a great reviser either, on the level of revising a book. Each page, and I've seen examples of his manuscripts and his typescripts where he might work through an individual page, typing it out up to 10 times. Mm. And then when it was finished, he moved on to the next page. So the waste basket would fill up with kind of provisional versions of each page. But having finished a book, he didn't then go back and rework it, rewrite it. He wanted to write another book. So he would revise on the level of the page, but not on the level of the complete book.
I should mention in the restored text that you've edited, you include these terrific images from the actual manuscript, and he seems to be quite a doodler.
Well, this comes up quite a lot in some of his other books as well. There are kind of two kinds of annotation that you find on the Clockwork Orange manuscript, and the first kind, I'd say, are... It's a series of notes to either himself or to his editor.
Yeah.
And because he's working on a language that's based on Russian, he writes sometimes in English, sometimes in Cyrillic. And he's, I think, on occasion, these are notes to himself, reminding himself that he needs to look a word up and check the exact spelling or pronunciation of it. So you've got kind of linguistic notes. And then beyond that, he draws images of the characters, and he draws oranges with cogs spewing out of them and so forth. And there is the possibility that he'd intended A Clockwork Orange to be an illustrated novel. Now, some of Burgess's other novels of this period were published with illustrations by an Australian artist called Edward Pagram. Mm. And I think the presence of these illustrations in the manuscript at least raises the possibility that he was thinking, well, should it be a kind of picture book or an illustrated novel? Mm. And the other thing that you find in the manuscript is music, and that I have managed to put back, because there are passages of music that you find elsewhere in Burgess's novels, and the music which is present in the manuscript of A Clockwork Orange hadn't been published before. So this seemed a good opportunity to restore it. It's the hymn that the prisoners sing in Part 2, Chapter 1.
Andrew Biswell. He directs the International Anthony Burgess Foundation. He's the editor of a restored text edition of A Clockwork Orange. The Salt Lake Film Society is screening Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of the novella this weekend at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. You can find showtimes and more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about A Clockwork Orange. Many of you know it as the surreal and violent film by Stanley Kubrick, but this conversation is about the book the film was based on. It's a novella by the British writer Anthony Burgess. He created this dystopian landscape with violent teenagers who have their own language. Andrew Biswell is joining us. He directs the International Anthony Burgess Foundation. He's editor of a restored text version of A Clockwork Orange, and he's joining us from the BBC studios in Manchester. Andrew Biswell, I wanted to ask you, what was it that fascinated Anthony Burgess about these dystopian landscapes? Because you say that long before he began to write about them, you know, these utopian or dystopian societies, he read a lot about them. What was it that fascinated him about them, do you think?
I think there's always the fascination of the future, especially the terrible future. I mean, in a sense, every every work of science fiction, but every speculative work about the future is a kind of allegory of the present with certain tendencies exaggerated. And there were, in fact, two dystopias that Burgess published in 1962. There was A Clockwork Orange, which I suppose looked at from one angle might be thought of as a kind of fable about youthful aggression, but also the violence of the state, which moves in to try and, you know, kind of do something about these terrible crimes young people are committing and to program and condition and improve young people. And in writing that story, Burgess was really trying to capture a number of things that were in the air around the time that he was writing it. The other book he wrote in 62 is called The Wanting Seed, which is about overpopulation. And the problem of feeding a growing, hungry population. And Burgess's solution to that one is cannibalism, of course. It's only logical that we'll end up eating each other. So there's a different kind of dystopia and kind of nightmare in The Wanting Seed. But as far as A Clockwork Orange went, I think...
I wanted to step in there, though, because I'm so interested in The Wanting Seed, because the future, in this version of the future, religion is outlawed. And interesting, homosexuality is promoted as the kind of the policy that helps you control the birth rate, which led me to wonder about his own kind of views. I mean, you talk about, you've written about the fact that he was raised Catholic, and so he had a hard time, I think, as you've put it, shaking off his belief in original sin. So how do you describe sort of his perspective? You know, if it's a religious perspective or sort of ideological perspective that informed all of that.
I think, I mean, Burgess is very much a person of his time, not simply in having had a very difficult relationship with the sort of ultra-Catholicism of his boyhood. He was the product of, single-sex Catholic schools in Manchester. And by the time he'd finished his school education, he'd kind of fallen out of his church, as far as being a communicating member of it. But of course, like many people who've grown up as people of faith, he could never jettison, you know, the kind of intellectual framework, a way of looking at the world. And the big thing that he retained, as you say, is his belief in original sin. He was, in a sense, a kind of Augustinian Catholic. And many of his novels are informed by that way of thinking about the world. At the same time, he'd been conscripted into the army during the Second World War. He'd known gay and lesbian people all his life. And I think if you consider his novels as a whole, I mean, there are 33 of them altogether, you've always got at least one gay or lesbian character. And there are novels which engage very directly with the subject of homosexuality. For example, Earthly Powers, this kind of huge novel which is narrated by a kind of Somerset Maugham character. And the last novel that he published in his lifetime, A Dead Man in Deptford, which is about the playwright Christopher Marlowe and his assassination. And in Burgess's conspiracy theory version of things, Marlowe is assassinated partly because of his homosexuality, which the book dramatizes with great sort of relish and so forth. So I think, though Burgess himself was quite conventionally heterosexual, and, you know, he married a few times, and he had kids, and, you know, all of the things one expects from that, he was fascinated by the subject, and it's there in virtually any of his novels. You don't have to look very, very hard to sort of see its presence.
You know, when you're talking about the sort of view from a dystopian world, he seemed that to resist the sense of hopelessness, though. Like, he didn't seem pessimistic on some level about the future. I mean, you've, for example, written about his reaction to George Orwell's 1984. And he, if I get this right, he seemed to think that Orwell had underestimated the ability of people to resist oppression, that it didn't have to be as bleak and hopeless as all of that. Is that right?
I think that's true. I think Burgess believed in kind of humor and language as the things that get us through especially when circumstances may seem quite unpromising. Mm-hmm. And his big disagreement with Orwell in 1984 is that Orwell is only really interested in the sort of clerical people, the middle class. And there's this other section of people who Orwell designates the proles. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, cattle. They don't matter. They could never sort of organize or resist in any way. And they are fed, you know, kind of songs and pornography and things to keep them occupied. But I think Burgess, he disagreed very strongly with Orwell's conception of what the, you know, the masses or the working class or, you know, however you're going to designate it. He thought that there was something there. And partly this came out of his experience in the army when he wasn't part of the officer class. He was one of the men. Mm. You know, he was an ordinary soldier. And he became quite adept at finding ways to not to disobey orders, but to obey them very kind of reluctantly and sarcastically. And I think once again, you know, you could look to his biography for some kind of answer. But also, I think, given that he was from quite a humble place, the districts he grew up in Manchester were not wealthy by any means, and he was himself the product of, you know, some pretty unfortunate circumstances. His mother dropped dead when he was 18 months old, and his father was a drinker and didn't really want to know about him. And I think he developed his own kind of resistance, and that was mostly about music and literature and the kind of artistic freedom out of which he was able to kind of make an identity and a personality.
Mm. Well, of course, there's the first section of the book, which is about crime. It's difficult to read. It's violent and seems, you know, really completely terrible, of course. Then we get to the kind of punishment phase, which is interesting. I mean, Alex is imprisoned, of course, and he submits to this kind of behavior modification technique. And I wanted to ask you about that, because this seems to get us to something that Anthony Burgess thought a lot about. And this was the idea of how the behavior modification, which was, I guess, in the 60s when he was thinking about all of this, was really on a lot of people's minds, that it stripped a person of their free will. This was an important concept in the book, and I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Well, I think freedom of choice, freedom, if necessary, to be bad. Mm-hmm. These are the things which stand at the heart of Burgess's convictions about personal individual liberty. That's something that, again, it sort of comes out of his religious upbringing. I mean, that these philosophical categories of free will, freedom of choice, you know, you could trace that right back to St. Augustine. Yeah. Once again. And looking for a way to dramatize that, Burgess didn't have to look very far, because he found in the newspapers around him in the late 50s and early 60s, quite serious newspapers were talking about, for example, curing alcoholics by using chemical, yeah, or, you know, sort of electrical stimuli, aversion therapies. They were talking about curing people of being gay or lesbian by, you know, brainwashing and these techniques of chemical persuasion. And I think there was something in Burgess that simply revolted. At the prospect of people being denied and somehow, you know, engineered and programmed and robbed of their individual liberty. Mm. This is the great sort of provocation of A Clockwork Orange. The proposition it puts forward is essentially this, you know, that the book is arguing that it is better to have criminals like Alex, who, you know, they go around robbing. He murders people. He rapes people. That is better than to have somebody who is programmed simply to do good. Mm. And it's a very difficult, you know, philosophical idea to get your head around. But that is the big kind of message of the book. And I think that's why it's still resonating after 50 years.
There's a part in the second section, the chapter one of the first chapter of that second section, where Alex is talking to a prison chaplain about this technique that he's heard of that that would compel a prisoner to behave himself and keep him that way. I want to have a section from this. Anything to say about this particular moment? Because it seems to get at that idea of free will, freedom of choice.
Yeah, I think this is one of the places where the book is most forthright about its kind of philosophizing and its thinking about the morality of choice.
Here's the actor Tom Hollander performing a reading from A Clockwork Orange.
"But it's being used here, isn't it, sir?" I said. "Those new, like, white buildings by the south wall, sir? We've watched those being built, sir, when we've been doing our exercise." "It's not been used yet," he said. "Not in this prison, 6655321. Himself has grave doubts about it. I must confess, I share those doubts. The question is whether such a technique can really make a man good. Goodness comes from within, 6655321. Goodness is something chosen. When a man cannot choose, he ceases to be a man."
What did the publishers make of the book when he finally submitted it? Because you write in your introduction to the restored text, one editor called it one of the oddest publishing problems imaginable.
That's true. When the book was submitted to its publisher in Britain, there was a kind of panic, which Burgess didn't really know about because it was discussed in internal papers, which have only just surfaced in the last few months, actually. This whole story emerges about a publisher which had been Nabokov's publisher before Lolita, and they turned that down because... Wow. 1961, when the book was delivered, was just a year after the trial for obscenity of D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was a kind of landmark case. And after that point, publishing was beginning to open up to some extent. But there were other cases later. For example, Hubert Selby, Last Exit to Brooklyn, later in the 60s. And at the time when A Clockwork Orange was published, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch was still banned in America and in most of Europe. So it required a certain amount of courage, I think, on the part of Norton in New York and Heinemann in London to publish this novel. And it's clear from the correspondence between the editors that they were very worried that readers might take exception to some of the content and say this was an obscene book. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, there were other cases in the States, in Boston. Naked Lunch was put on trial, and people like Allen Ginsberg were having terrible trouble with the law. So you've got those kinds of reactions coming out from the publishers. But the other thing that was argued about was how the book should end.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier in the program, I think, there were two versions. The novel circulated into distinct versions. In the United States, it had 20 chapters for many years, and Britain has always known the longer version with 21 chapters.
Well, let's explain. I mean, in the American version, at the end of part three, after chapter six, this would have been the 20th chapter. After that, we're sort of left where Alex's behavior modification has been washed away. He no longer has an aversion to violence. He no longer has an aversion to his, of course, beloved classical music. He's kind of back to where he started, I guess, and that's where it ends. At least that's where most people in the United States would have seen it end. That he's back to the starting point, I guess. Is that the way to put it?
I think that would be true, yes. It's almost a complete circle. He's been through all these experiences, and then with no sense of any kind of moral, you know, regeneration or lessons having been learned, he ends the book in its 20-chapter version much as he'd begun it. And one of the reasons why Burgess was quite sceptical about that particular ending, which America preferred and which Kubrick preferred, was that he thought that characters in novels, you know, should should be enriched somehow, should learn something from their experiences. And there's a very uncompromising circularity about the short version, the 20-chapter version. And Burgess said that made it more of a fable than a novel.
Huh. I want to this is Tom Hollander again, the actor, performing this reading from Section 3, Chapter 6, where Alex has just received that behavioral treatment and he's giving a reward for his participation. And this is how it ends, at least as Americans would read it.
What was brought in now, brothers, was a big, shiny box, and I vidded clear what sort of a vesh it was. It was a stereo. It was put down next to the bed and opened up, and some vet plugged in its lead into the wall socket. "What shall it be?" asked a vet with otches on his nose. And then he had in his rookers lovely, shiny sleeves full of music. "Mozart, Beethoven, Schoenberg, Karl Orff, the Ninth," I said, "the glorious Ninth." And the Ninth it was, oh my brothers. Everybody began to leave, nice and quiet, while I laid there with my glasses closed, slooshing the lovely music. The Min said, "Good, good boy," patting me on the plecho. Then he itted off. Only one vet was left, saying, "Sign here, please." I opened my glasses up to sign, not knowing what I was signing, and not, oh my brothers, caring either. Then I was left alone with the glorious Ninth of Ludwig van. Oh, it was gorgiosity and yum, yum, yum. When it came to the scherzo, I could vidy myself very clear, running and running on light, very light and mysterious nogas, carving the whole litzo of the creaching world with my cutthroat Britva. And there was the slow movement, and the lovely last singing movement still to come. I was cured all right.
So he no longer has this aversion to his beloved classical music, which means he's thinking violently again, and that's where you're left. And you say that in the manuscript, there's a note in Burgess's handwriting that asks the question, should we end here? The Americans say, yes, let's end it here. It makes more sense. It's up in the air. His British editor thought, no, let's have the epilogue. Let's resolve this. Maybe that's not quite the way to put it, but and there's a controversy, I guess, in some ways as to what Burgess really wanted. Do you think you understand? I mean, he wrote the epilogue, but why did he write, should we end it here?
It's a very odd example. I mean, almost unique in the history of, you know, fiction writing, I think, an author who, at the point where he's delivering his novel to various publishers in New York and in London, genuinely does not know what the correct ending should be and isn't prepared to make that decision, yeah. Simply hands it over to these two editors who arrive at opposite decisions. And I can see both sides of it. And I think Burgess, too, he believed in different endings at different points in his career. It's very interesting if you look at the film script that he wrote before Kubrick in the late 60s, he's showing a preference at that point for the short version.
Right.
He ends at chapter 20. And then a few years later, when he adapted A Clockwork Orange as a musical play, as, you know, theater, at that point, he's decided to go for the long ending. So, you know, if it's a question of which ending Burgess believed to be right, the answer has to be, you know, it depends on kind of what period of time you're going to look at. Mm. And he held different opinions at different times about that.
It's so interesting. You in your biography, you write about this interview that he did in 1985, Burgess, where he said that in the English version, you know, he talks about how Alex grows up and he understands violence is just an aspect of youth. And this is interesting. He says that he will use it. This is Burgess talking about. This is so interesting that he sees Alex using that awareness of violence, now looking back on how violent he was, as something that he would use to create, and that he becomes this great musician. And you write, Andrew, that this showed how A Clockwork Orange was still kind of alive for him imaginatively. He was still working out what happens with Alex in some way.
I was very surprised to find that interview where Burgess says very clearly that after the end of the novel, well, implicitly, it should be obvious to the reader that Alex is going to become a composer or a musician. Yeah. And this had never occurred to me. I've been reading the book for, you know, a long time before I found that comment. And I suppose on one level, it's kind of gestured towards, because he is very interested in music. And he says that he's going to get a job working in a record store and so forth. But I think it would be true to say that this story does not stand still in Burgess's head after he has completed the novel. And, you know, he went on writing prologues and epilogues, and making new adaptations and trying to turn it into a Broadway musical. And the language kept moving on as well, because in these different adaptations that he made later in life, there are new items of vocabulary, new new words which enter this invented language. So I think it would be true to say, yeah, imaginatively, it was still alive for him, even a quarter of a century after he'd published the book.
Mm. I want to, as we head into this break, I want to play another clip. This is from chapter 21, section 3, chapter 7, from the final pages of the book. And I guess the way to set this up is to say Alex is coming home from work, you know, to a good hot plate of dinner. And in the other room is a baby, a son, gurgling away. So he settled down. He's finished with the ultraviolence. He's raising a family, which is not to say, I think, Andrew Biswell, that it's tidy or wrapped up. I guess you could also say that even this view of, you know, him sort of in suburbia is as bleak as any. But what do you want to say about this sort of last moment here?
I'd say that here he is imagining what the future might look like. Alex says that he's growing up. He's now 18 years old, which is not a young age. And he's thinking about, you know, this unknown experience which might lie beyond being a teenager.
My son, when I had my son, I would explain all that to him when he was starry enough to, like, understand. But then I knew he would not understand or would not want to understand at all and would do all the veshes I had done, yes, perhaps even killing some poor starry forella surrounded with mewing cots and koshkas, and I would not be able to really stop him. And nor would he be able to stop his own son, brothers. And so it would itty on to, like, the end of the world, round and round and round, like some bolshy gigantic, like Chelovic, like old Bog himself, by courtesy of Corova Milk Bar, turning and turning and turning a vonny, grasny orange in his gigantic rookers. But first of all, brothers, there was this vesh of finding some devotchka or other who would be a mother to this son. I would have to start on that tomorrow, I kept thinking. That was something like new to do. That was something I would have to get started on. A new, like, chapter beginning. That's what it's going to be then, brothers, as I come to the, like, end of this tale. You have been everywhere with your little droog, Alex, suffering with him, and you have vidded some of the most grasny brachnies old Bog ever made, all on to your old droog, Alex. And all it was that I was young. But now, as I end this story, brothers, I am not young. Not no longer, oh no. Alex, like, groweth up. Oh, yes.
From A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess, Andrew Biswell is with us, directs the International Anthony Burgess Foundation. He's the editor of a restored text version of A Clockwork Orange. You can see Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of the novella on the big screen. It's showing this weekend at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with our scholar Andrew Biswell. We're talking about Anthony Burgess's book, A Clockwork Orange. The film adaptation by Stanley Kubrick is showing this weekend at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. We've got details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Andrew Biswell, I wanted to ask you, let me get to this question because it was one I was going to ask too. It comes from Ted, who writes from Layton, Utah. Where did the name come from?
A Clockwork Orange is previously unrecorded in the history of English slang. Burgess said that he'd been in a pub in London during the Second World War, and an ancient man had been overheard saying that something was as queer as a clockwork orange. Hmm. Queer, in this case, meaning not homosexual, but right. strange or odd. Yeah. There are kind of equivalent expressions. I mean, in London, where I'm from, people talk about a bottle of crisps or a £9 note or something. Hearing this, Burgess said, he stored it away as a possible title. He was very taken by, I suppose, the strangeness and the musicality of the phrase. Mm. And he quite often did this. There are other of his novels. For example, Tremor of Intent. He had the title and he carried it around for years and years in his notebook, wow, looking for the novel to which that would attach. Very often, I think he found it very difficult to find the appropriate title for a novel. And there's one book which goes through about sort of 10 different titles before eventually he decided to call it Earthly Powers. Mm-hmm. He'd wanted to call it The Instruments of Darkness, but there was another book which was A History of Radar, which was already called that. But I think on this occasion, A Clockwork Orange, you know, it's an example of a book finding, you know, precisely the right title. A Plank in Your Eye was another possibility that he toyed with before he rejected it. Hmm. So A Clockwork Orange is what it became.
Yeah. It's hard to tell what he thought of the book. In some ways, it seems like it was a curse for him in some ways. Didn't want to be defined by just that one book. But on the other hand, you get a sense that he did have some kind of affection for the book as well. What do you think? What did he make of the book finally?
I think he was quite worried by this book, that it was a work that he'd done at quite an early stage in his career as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of ran away. I think his fear was that it had moved beyond his control and that other people, including Andy Warhol, who made a film out of it in 1965, right, and Stanley Kubrick later on, that these other people who had somehow kind of appropriated it, taken it away. He was very worried about this. And Burgess wrote, shortly after Kubrick's film came out, another book, which is called The Clockwork Testament, mm-hmm, which is a novel. But within that novel, he describes a lot of his anxieties about being somehow misrepresented or travestied as an artist. And he sets up another kind of fictional story, which involves a writer whose work has been bought by Hollywood and has then been distorted. Mm. So I think one of his motivations for returning to this novel throughout his life, and he always said, oh, it's a very minor work of mine and I don't want people to read it and I've kind of renounced it. Mm-hmm. And yet he could not leave it alone, or it would not leave him alone. And I think in reworking it as he did and translating it for film, translating it for musical theatre, he was wanting to kind of assert his ownership of it, also to rethink it and, yeah, to reimagine it and to put it into different genres. So, for example, I mean, when it comes towards the end of his life onto the stage, it's become a kind of comedy. Yeah. It's very different from the tone of either the original novel or from Kubrick's film of that novel.
Well, in one version, a bearded character enters playing Singing in the Rain and is kicked off the stage by the other actors, which gives you a sense of what he thought of Kubrick in some ways, I guess, right?
He lost few opportunities to be rude about Kubrick towards the end. And yet, you know, at the same time, he's mentioning him. He's saying, this, right, is not Kubrick's, and then he's putting Kubrick on the stage. Yeah. So there's something very, very complicated about that response to the film that he dramatizes within his own play.
Let me ask you this finally. What do you, right now, these days, when people hear A Clockwork Orange, are they thinking of Kubrick or are they thinking of Burgess? And because I think I wonder if that worries you. I guess that they come to find this work not through the film, which is, you know, whatever you think about it, I think it's quite great. But this book is something entirely is another thing entirely.
Well, I think increasingly people are thinking of Burgess again.
Yeah.
Either because they're reading the novel or else because they're watching the play. And recently, I mean, there's been a very big production of the theatrical version as a kind of rock opera that did a stadium tour in Japan. Mm-hmm. In Germany, there's been a production that's been on tour for many years. There's about to be another production in Australia. The play is being performed in London at the moment. So it's hard to know. The Kubrick film, it's a really, you know, it's an important, it's a great film. It's a classic film. It's not going to go away, but you have to remember it's kind of one interpretation among many.
Andrew Biswell directs the International Anthony Burgess Foundation. He's editor of a restored text edition of A Clockwork Orange. The Salt Lake Film Society is screening Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of the novella this weekend at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. You can find showtimes and more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.